Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Lal by Flora Annie Steele. Who was Lal? What was he? This was a question I asked many times, and though it was duly answered, Lal remained and remains still an unknown quantity, an abstraction, a name, and nothing more. L-A-L. The same backwards and forwards, self-contained, self-sufficing. The first time I heard of Lal was on a bright spring morning, one of those mornings when the plains of northern India glitter with dewdrops, when a purple haze of cloud mountain bounds the pale wheat fields to the north, and a golden glow strikes skyward from the sand hills in the south. I was in a tamarisk jungle on the banks of the Indus, engaged in the decorous records of all the thefts and restitutions made during the year by that most grasping and generous of rivers. For year after year, armed by the majesty of law and bucklered by foot rules and maps, the government of India, in the person of one of its officers, came gravely and altered the proportion of land and water on the surface of the globe, while the river gurgled and dimpled as if it were laughing in its leave. Strange work, but pleasant too, with a charm of its own wrought by infinite variety and sudden surprise, sometimes watching the stream sapping at a wheat field, where the tender green spikes fringe the edges of each crack and fissure in the fast-drying soil. A promise of harvest, and then, sheer down, the turbid water gnawing hungrily, every now and again a splash telling that another inch or two of solid earth had yielded. Sometimes standing on a mud bank where the ever-watchful villagers had sown a trial crop of coarse vetch, thus, as it were, casting their bread on the water in hopes of finding it again some day. But when? Would it be there at harvest time? Gray-bearded patriarchs from the village would wag their head sagely over the problem, and younger voices protest that it was not worthwhile to enter such a flotsam jetsam as a field. But the ruthless iron chain would come into requisition, and another green spot be daubed on the revenue map. For governments ignore chance, and still the river dimpled and gurgled with inward mirth, for if it gave the vetch, had it not taken the wheat? So from one scene of loss or gain to another, while the sun shone in the cloudless sky overhead, past pools of shining water where red-billed cranes stood huddled up on one leg as if they felt cold in the crisp morning air, out on the bare stretches of sand where glittering streams and flocks of white egrets combined to form a silver embroidery on the brown expanse, over the shallow ford where the bottlenosed alligator slipped silently into the stream or lay still as shadows on the sun-baked sand, down by the big river where the swirling water parted right and left, and where the graybeards set their earthen pots a-swimming to decide which of the two streams would provide its strength by bearing away the greater number, a weighty question not lightly to be decided, since the land to the west of the big stream belonged to one village, and the land eastward to another. Back again to higher ground, through thickets of tamarisk dripping with dew, the bushes sparse below with their thin brown stem, so thick above were the feathery pink-spiked branches interlaced. Riding through it, the hands had to defend the face from the sharp switch of the rosy flowers as they swung back disentangled. Such tiny flowers, too, no bigger than a mustard seed, and leaving a pink powder of pollen behind them. It was after forcing my way through one of these tamarisk jungles that I came out on an open patch of rudely plowed land, where a mixed crop of pulse and barley grew sturdily, outlining an irregular oval with a pale green carpet glistening with dew. In the center, a shallow pool of water still testified to past floods, and from it a purple heron winged its flight, lazily craning its painted neck against the sky. The whole posse comitas of the village followed me, broke by twos and threes through the jungle, and gathered round me as I paused watching the bird's flight. "Take the bridle from his honor's pony," cried a venerable pantaloon breathlessly. "Let the steed of the Lord of the Universe eat his fill. Is not this the field of Lal? 20 hands stretched out to do the old man's bidding. 20 voices re-echoed the sentiment in varying words. A minute more, my pony's nose was well down on the wet, sweet tufts of vetch, and I was asking for the first time, "Who is Lal?" "Lal," came the answer. "Why, Lal was Lal. This was his field. Why should not the pony of the protector of the poor have a bellyful? Was it not more honorable than the parrot people and the squirrel people and the pig people who battened on the field of Lal? It was early days yet for the flocks of green parents to frequent the crops, and the dainty squirrels were, I knew, still snugly abed, waiting for the sun to dry the dew. But at my feet sundry furrows and scratches told that the pigs had already been at work. "Is Lal here?" I asked. A smile, such as greets a child's innocent ignorance, came to the good-humored faces around me. "Lal," they explained, "came when the crop was ripe, when the parrot, the squirrel, and the pig people, and his honor's pony, too, had had their fill. Lal was a good man, one who walked straight and labored truly." "But where is he?" I insisted. Face looked at face, half puzzled, half amused. Who could tell where Lal was? He might be miles away or in the next jungle. Someone had seen him at Sukkur a week ago, but that was no reason why he should not be at Bukur now, for Lal followed the river, and like it was here today, gone tomorrow. Balked in my curiosity, I took refuge in business by inquiring what revenue Lal paid on his field. This was too much for the polite gravity of my hearers. The idea of Lal paying revenue was evidently irresistibly comic, and the venerable pantaloon actually choked himself between a cough and a laugh, requiring to be held up and pat on the back. "But someone must pay the revenue," I remarked a little testily. "Certainly, the Lord of the Universe was right. The village community paid it. It was the village which lent Lal the field, and the bullocks and the plow. It was the village which gave him the few handful of seed grain to scatter broadcast over the roughly tilled soil. So much they lent to Lal. The sun and the good God gave him the rest. All, that is to say, that was not wanted for the parrot, the pig, and the squirrel people, and of course for the pony of the Lord of the Universe. There are so many mysteries in Indian peasant life, safely hidden from alien eyes, that I was lazily content to let Lal and his field slip into limbo of things not thoroughly understood, and so ere long I forgot all about him. Spring passed ripening the crops, summer came bringing fresh floods to the river, and autumn watched the earth once more make way against the water, but Lal was to me as though he had not been. It was only when another year found me once more in the strange land which lies, as the natives say, in the stomach of the river, that memory awoke with the words, "This is the field of Lal." There was, however, no suggestion made about loosening my pony's bridle as on the former occasion. The reason for such reticence became palpable. Lal had either been less fortunate in his original choice of a field this year, or else the sun and the good God had been less diligent caretakers. A large portion of the land, too, bore marks of an over-recent flood in a thick deposit of fine glistening white sand, a favorite trick of the mischievous Indus, by which he disappoints hope raised by previous gifts of rich alluvial soil, a trick which has given her a bad name, the worst a woman can bear, because she gives and destroys with one hand. Here and there in patches the sparse crop showed green, but for the most part the ground lay bare, cracking into large fissures under the noonday sun and peeling at the top into shiny brown scales. "A bad lookout for Lal," I remarked. "Bad," they said, "for the squirrel people and the parrot people, no doubt, but for Lal, that was another matter. Lal did not live by bread alone. The river gave, the river took away, but to Lal, at any rate, it gave more than it stole." "What does it give?" I asked. "It gave crocodiles." "Of all things in the world, crocodiles?" "Not a welcome sight to many, but Lal, it seemed, was a hunter of crocodiles, not a mere slayer of alligators, like the men of the half-savage tribes who frequent the riverland, who array themselves in a plethora of blue beads and live by the creeks and geels of what they can catch or steal, who track the cumbersome beast to their nightly lair in some narrow inlet, and after barring escape by a stealthy earthwork, fall on the helpless creature at dawn with spears and arrow. Lal was not one of these. He was of another temper. He hunted the crocodile in its native element, stalked it through the quicksands, knife in hand, dived with it into the swift stream, sped like a fish to the soft belly underneath, and struck upwards with an erring hand, once, twice, thrice, while the turbid orange water glowed crimson with the spouting blood. I heard this tale curiously but incredulously. Why, I asked, should Lao run such risks? What good were crocodiles to him when they were slain? There was not so much risk after all, I replied, for it was only the bottle-nosed ones that he hunted, and though, of course, the snub-nosed ones lived in the river also, God destroy the horrid monsters, still, they did not interfere in the fight, and Lao was careful, all the more careful because he had but two possessions to guard, his skin and his knife. As to what Lao did with the crocodiles, why, he ate them, of course. Not all, he spared some for his friends, for those who were good to him, and gave him something in return. Had the presence never heard that the poor ate crocodile flesh? They themselves, of course, did not touch the unclean animal, and their gifts to Lao were purely disinterested. He was a straight-walking, a laborful man, and that was the only reason why they lent him a field. Even the presence would acknowledge that crocodile flesh without bread would be an interesting diet, but as a rule the pig, the parrots, the squirrels left enough for Lao to eat with his jerk meat. The village lent him the sickle, of course, and the flail and the mill, sometimes even the girdle on which to bake the unleavened bread, but all for love, only for love. Yet, if the presence desired it, they could show him the jerk meat, some that Lao had left for the poor. It was dry? Oh, yes. Cut the great beast into strips and laid them in the sun on the dry sand, sitting beside them to scare away the carrion birds. Sometimes there could be a crowd of vultures, and Lao with his knife sitting in the midst. He will have to sell some of his jerk crocodile to pay his revenue this year, I remarked, just to amuse them. Again, the idea was comic. Evidently, Lao and money were incompatible, and the very idea of his owning any caused them to chuckle unrestrainedly amongst themselves. Then, growing grave, they explained at length how Lao had nothing in the world but his knife. All the rest, the sun, the river, the crocodiles, the field, the bullocks, the plow, and the seed grain, were lent to him by them, and the good God lent to him, and to the other people who ate of the field of Lao. As I rode away, a brace of black partridges rose from one of the green patches, and close to the tamarisk shelter, a brown rat sat balancing a half-dried stack of barley. The river gleamed in the distance, a wedge-shaped flight of Kulin cleft to sky. All that day, when the shadow-like crocodile slipped into the sliding water, I thought of Lao and his knife. Was it a crocodile after all? Or was it a man, stealthily swift and silent? Who could tell, when there was nothing but a shadow, a slip, and then a few air bubbles on the sliding river? Or was that Lao yonder, where the vultures ringed a sandbank far on the western side? Why not? None knew whence he came or whither he went, what he hoped or what he feared. Only his field bore witness to one human frailty, hunger, and that he shared with the pig and the parrot and the squirrel people. But, though my thoughts were full of Lao for a day or two, the memory of him passed as I left the riverland, and once more spring, summer, and autumn brought forgetfulness. There were busy times for all the revenue officers next year. The fitful river had chosen to desert its eastern bank altogether and concentrate its force upon the western, so while yard after yard of ancestral land was giving away before the fierce stream, amidst much wringing of hands on the one side, there was joy on the other over long, rich stretches, ready for the plow and the red tape of measurement. In the press of work, even the sight of the riverland failed to awake any memory of Lao. It was not until I was re-entering the outskirts of the village at sundown that something jogged my brain, making me turn to the posse comitatus behind me and ask, "And where this year is the field of Lao?" We were passing over an open space, baked almost to whiteness by the constant sun, a hard, resonant place set round with gnarled Jahan trees and dotted over with innumerable little mud mounds. "There," wheezed the venerable Pantaloon, pressing forward and pointing to one newer than the rest. "That is the field of Lao." Then I saw that we were in the village burial ground. I looked up inquiringly. "Huzur," repeated a younger man, "that is Lao's field. It is his own this time. But for all that, the Sikar will not charge him revenue." The grim joke and the idea of Lao's having 6 feet of earth of his own at last once more roused their sense of humor. "And the other people who wait of the field of Lao?" I asked, half in earnest, for somehow my heart was sad. "The good God will look after them, as he has after the crocodiles." Since then, strangely enough, the memory of Lao has remained with me. and I often ask myself if he really existed, and if he really died. Does he still slip silently into the stream, knife in hand? Does he still come back to his field, under the broad harvest moon, to glean his scanty share after the other people have had their fill? I cannot say, but whenever I see a particularly fat squirrel, I say to myself, it has been feeding in the field of Lao. The White Tiger by Alice Perrin. He was called the White Tiger by the villagers of the district because his yellow skin was pale with age and his stripes so faded and far apart as to be almost invisible. Having grown too large and heavy for cattle killing with any ease, he had lately become a man-eater, and terrible were the stories told by those who had seen him and escaped the fatal blow of his huge paw. He was described as being the size of a bull buffalo, with a belly that reached the ground and a white moon between his ears, true tokens of the man-eater, as every native of India knows. He was said to have the power of assuming different shapes and to lure his prey by the imitation of a human voice, and certainly his craft and cunning were such that even Marsing, the local shikari, had ever been able to trap him or obtain a shot at him with his famous matchlock gun. And Marsing had seen the tiger often, knew his favorite haunts and lairs, and could point out the very trees upon which he preferred to sharpen his murderous claws. The brute continued to levy his terrible tax on the scanty population of a remote district, until the women and children were afraid to leave the village, and the men went out to work in the fields, fearing for their lives. At last, the increasing number of victims attracted the attention of the local authorities, and a reward of 100 rupees was placed on the head of the White Tiger, with the result that Marsing, who had clothed himself in khaki with a disreputable turban to match, and was regarded in his village as the wariest of hunters, redoubled his efforts to bring about the destruction of this awful scourge. Also, now that the fame of the White Tiger's misdeeds had penetrated to headquarters, it was more than likely that a party of sahibs would appear on the scene with elephants and rifles, in which case, though the tiger would be doomed, the reward would be distributed amongst the mahouts and the beaters, and Marsing himself would only receive a share. So night after night, he perched in the branches of the trees above the favorite routes of the enemy, and from sunrise to sunset, he haunted the outskirts of the jungle, and hung about the drinking pools in the bed of the shrinking river. For unlike his cattle and game-killing brothers, the man-eater may be sought for at all hours. But to no purpose. The White Tiger seized a plump human victim once every few days, and Marsing's vision of the reward grew faint. The striped one is surely an evil spirit, and no beast at all, said Marsing, who never uttered the word tiger, if he could help it, for fear of ill luck. He had come in weary and crestfallen, from a long day's search, having actually caught a glimpse of the White Tiger, and followed the tracks of the huge square pugs to the edge of a thorny thicket, without the chance of a shot that could have taken effect, and he was pouring out his irritation and disgust to Kauta, his half-brother, who sat at the door of the family hovel, contentedly smoking a hookah. Without doubt, agreed Kauta, and therefore would it not be wiser to let the sahib slay the evil one if he be able? What sahib? Asked Marsing sharply, pausing in the act of cleaning the precious matchlock gun, which was the envy and admiration of the village. Then thou hast not heard the news? Said Kauta innocently. A sahib has pitched his camp within one day's march of the village, and they say he has come to hunt the white devil. The dreaded blow had fallen, and Marsing danced with rage. I will give him no news of the tiger. I will tell him nothing, and see, too, that thou remainest silent, Kauta, when he sends for information, else will it be the worse for thee. Kauta twiddled his big toe in the dust. Oh, it was a sign of hesitation with a native, and Marsing scented trouble. He knew that Kauta was heavily in debt to the village usher, and that sahibs often paid well for news of a tiger's movements. He was also aware that Kauta was jealous of his standing and reputation in the village, which would be increased tenfold could he but destroy the tiger and earn the magnificent reward. He changed his tone. See, brother, he began insinuatingly, the utmost that the sahib would give thee might perchance be 10 rupees, and thy share of the government reward would scarcely be more than 2. What are 12 rupees compared with 40 added to half the whiskers and claws of the evil one, and perhaps the lucky bone as well? All this will I give thee when I slay the beast, as I most assuredly must do if the sahib does not interfere." Kalta puffed slowly at his hookah and was manly silent. "Also," he continued, "consider the trouble that a sahib's camp brings upon a village. His servants, being rascals, will order supplies in the name of the sahib and pay us nothing for them, and the police will annoy us if we complain. We shall be forced to beat the jungle, and many will be hurt and some killed, if not by the tiger, then by other wild beasts. Also, but," interrupted Kalta cautiously, "how can I tell that thou wilt give me the 40 rupees and half the claws and whiskers, whereas a sahib holds to his promises, as we all know?" "I swear it," cried Mar Singh with fervor, "by the skin of the white devil, I swear to deal well by thee." So, after some further argument, Kalta reluctantly agreed to take his brother's side, and Mar Singh unfolded a scheme by which Kalta was to proceed to the tents of the unwelcome Englishmen and pose as the shikari of the district, possessing an intimate knowledge of the tiger's habits. Mar Singh would keep Kalta well informed as to the movements of the tiger through the medium of the postman who ran from village to village with news and letters, and the sahib, at all hazards, was to be led in the wrong directions until he grew weary of the fruitless chase and withdrew from the district with his camp and elephants. Kalta, therefore, proceeded to don the khaki costume which he had long coveted, and the next morning he started on his diplomatic errand, while Mar Singh betook himself to the jungle to watch the movements of the white tiger, that he might warn Kalta by the evening runner as to which locality must be avoided the following day. Kalta enjoyed himself immensely at the camp. He arrived at sundown and was interviewed by the sahib himself, to whom he gave voluble but entirely false information concerning the tiger, and promised to lead him direct to the animal's lair in the morning. The sahib, being young and new to the country, retired to bed in happy anticipation, and Kalta repaired to the kitchen tent, where, surrounded by the servants, he sat smoking his hookah and relating blood-curdling tales of the doings of the white tiger. Natives seldom sleep till far in the night, and therefore the gathering was at its height when the jingle of bells told of the postman's approach, and Kalta, explaining to the company that he was expecting news of his dying grandmother, went out into the moonlight to meet him. The chink-chink of the bells grew louder and mingled with the regular grunts of the runner, and Kalta, stepping forward into the sandy path, checked the man's rapid trot. "Oh, brother," he saluted, "what word from Mar Singh's shikari?" "Kalta, there is no word from the mouth of Mar Singh, thy brother, seeing that but an hour after thy departure he was slain by the white tiger on the outskirts of the grazing plain, and Mirjan, the cowherd, saw it happen. I bring the evil news to thee fresh from the village." For a moment Kalta was paralyzed by the horror of the dreadful and unexpected news. Then he asked questions, and learned that his brother's body had been recovered by a party of villagers who had sallied forth with drums and fireworks, and had driven the beast from its prey. The mangled remains now lay in the family hut, and Kalta's presence was required to make arrangements for the funeral. Kalta slipped some coppers into the postman's willing hand, and charged him to keep silence as to the catastrophe when delivering letters to the camp. Then he collected his belongings and left a plausible message for the sahib to say he had been summoned to his grandmother's deathbed, but would return with all haste the following day. He set out in the moonlight along the narrow jungle path, bordered by tall grass higher than his head, and walked rapidly through the heat was overpowering, until just as the dawn broke, he came within sight of the village. He strode through the fields of tobacco and young wheat, and saw the bright green parrots flashing to and fro in the vivid yellow light. Partridges ran from beneath his feet, calling shrilly as they disappeared behind the clumps of dry grass, and he could hear the jungle fowl in the distance crowing to the rising sun. Everything was awake and glowing with life, and the dark interior of the hut, where the women were wailing and the atmosphere seemed charged with death, became a sharp contrast to the outside world. The mangled body of the dead man, torn and chewed by the tiger, lay on the string bedstead, surrounded by a noisy group of mourning relatives. There was nothing for Kalta to do but arrange for the remains to be taken to the burning ground in the evening, and to attempt to pacify the wailing throng, until, as the fierce hot noon came on, they gradually dispersed, and even the widow of the dead man sought a siesta in a neighbor's hut, while Calta sat down on the threshold of his home to think. An idea had been slowly forming in his brain, which brought with it a wave of exultation. Why should not he compass the destruction of the white tiger, and so earn the whole reward? He was in debt to the money lender, and he also greatly desired a plot of land that was for sale just outside the village, and the 100 rupees would not only free him from debt, but would also purchase the coveted little piece of ground. It was true that Marcin himself had never succeeded in shooting the white tiger, but then his difficulty had always been the want of suitable bait, whereas now, Calta glanced back into the shadows of the hut and shivered, remembering the native belief that the soul of the tiger's victim becomes a servant of the slayer and is bound to warn the master when danger threatens. Marcin's spirit might or might not be in bondage to the white tiger, but in any case the 100 rupees was worth some risk, and with proper precautions there should be little or no danger, seeing that the matchlock gun had been recovered uninjured. Calta rose and looked up and down the little village street. Not a breeze stirred the giant leaves of the plantain trees. Not a bird uttered a note. Not a voice broke the breathless calm. Every creature, except himself, was wrapped in slumber. He made up his mind. He would attempt a plan, and afterwards, whether he succeeded or failed, he could deny all knowledge of the disappearance of his brother's body, and encourage the suggestion which would actually arise, that the sorcery of the white tiger had spirited the corpse away. So he gathered the wreck of Marcin into a bundle, wrapping it in his own white cotton waistcloth, and with a loaded matchlock over his shoulder, went swiftly through the sleeping village and out into the fields, invoking on his errand the blessing of Durga, the goddess who rides the tiger. Thence he took a narrow jungle path, with tangled shrubs closing over his head, and as he emerged from this onto the bushy broken ground, leading to the river, he gathered a leaf from the nearest tree and muttered, "As thy life has departed, so may the striped one die." He walked up the pebbly bed of the dwindling stream till he reached a pool of clear water, in the wet margin of which were printed countless tracks of animals that had drunk there during the night. Wild pig, jackal, fox, hyena, deer, all had slaked their thirst, but the white tiger had not been of the company. 100 yards off lay another pool, and around it Calta found a solitary track. The big square pugs of the beast, who by common consent of the other jungle inhabitants had been given a wide berth and allowed to drink alone. The marks were not more than a few hours old, and Calta followed them cautiously, grasping the gun and dragging his other burden behind him along the gravelly sand. The footprints led him to some rocky boulders, on the summit of which a family of monkeys sat peacefully hunting for fleas, a sign that the tiger was not on the move, else would they have been crashing and chattering in the nearest trees and pouring forth torrents of abuse. The pugs led on around the rocks into a shady thicket of thorn bushes in a deep ravine, and Calta felt that he had tracked the white tiger to his lair. He laid his brother's body close to the edge of the thorny thicket, and then cast about for a safe retreat with an easy shot. But no claimable trees were at hand, the cover consisting of low scrubby bushes. The only suitable place of concealment seemed to be the nearest rock, behind which it would be easy to hide and yet command a good view of the bait. The odor of the dead body tainted the air as the sun blazed full upon it, which suited Calta's purpose well, for tigers prefer their food as carrion, and hunger would soon bring the beast forth. Calta lay down behind the rock and waited. A hot high wind was blowing, and the sand from the riverbed getting into his eyes made them smart, but he paid no heed to the discomfort and only watched the thicket intently for the least movement. He held his breath when presently something rustled and crept out, merely a mangy little jackal with loosely hanging brush, who sprang 4 feet into the air as he came suddenly on Marcin's body. Then the animal uttered the long miserable wail known as the peacock cry, and ran back into the thicket, causing Calta's heart to beat high with hope, for he knew the jackal was a provider, one that gave notice to the tiger when food is to be found. Now, without doubt, the evil one would steal forth and nothing would then prevent a shot at such close quarters taking effect. A peafowl screeched wildly, and Kalta could hear the agitated flapping of its wings. That also was a token that the tiger moved. The monkey set up a chatter and scuttled from the rocks. He was coming, the white devil, the eel-striped one. Kalta waited breathless, his pulses throbbing in his ears, thinking of the 100 rupees and the plot of ground that were now almost his own, and gazing fixedly over the sickening twisted limbs of the mutilated body only a few yards from him. The tension was terrible, and the cracking of a dry twig behind him sounded almost like the report of a gun. He felt surging in his brain, and as another stick snapped, some irresistible power compelled him to turn his head. There, 5 yards behind him, crouched the white tiger, that with silent steps and awful cunning had stalked him from the village. The ears were flattened to the broad head, the long white whiskers bristled and quivered, the wicked yellow eyes glared and held the man helpless, spellbound with horror, waiting for the spring that came with a hissing, growling roar as the white tiger claimed yet another victim.